Let's start out with an anecdote from January of 1989. On the 19th of January 1989, Erich Honecker, who was the head of state in East Germany, the general secretary of the SED, or Socialist Unity Party, who had 28 years earlier been one of the individuals directly responsible for constructing the Berlin Wall in 1961, stated in a speech that anti-fascist protection wall had been very important in establishing the peace in Europe and maintaining stability from that point on. It would remain, he said, as long as conditions which had led to its construction were not altered. In other words, as long as the East and West was divided. He predicted that the wall would stand for another 50 or 100 years. Now, there's no doubt that in January of 1989, Erich Honecker sincerely believed that the wall would remain in place for another 100 years. And no one had any reason to disagree. I can't imagine that anyone has claimed that they predicted that within that year the wall would open up and the two German states would be unified in a single republic. There was change going on in Russia, Eastern Europe, and Central Europe. But nobody expected the East German regime to go along smoothly with that. It seemed to be stable, and it seemed to be stricter and more committed than the other states. At most, people might have expected a transitional reform that would follow suit over a long period of time. But to everyone's surprise, within 1 year, that anti-fascist protection wall was opened and began to be removed. The East German Socialist Unity Party fell, and by October of 1990, the two Germanies had been reunited. There was really no indication of that in 1988-1989. The film that we'll be looking at, of course, was done much later, but takes place in 1984 with a postscript that takes place in 1989-1990. So the world that we're looking at is that of the East German state at its height, one might say, in the middle of the 80s. So the first thing we need to do is just do a quick survey of how things got to that point and what the basic conditions were within that state. We've already covered the events and issues of the period immediately after the Second World War, referred to as Zero Hour from 1945 to 1949, in laying out the foundation of the West German state. So for the basic details of that period, you can go back to the previous lecture recording. But let's take a look at some of the key issues there and just summarize some of those. First of all, we talked about the Russian methods of occupation in the Eastern Zone. It undertook a strict policy of denazification, which involved eliminating all leaders of former German politics and the economy, associating capitalism with National Socialism, according to the Marxist-Leninist interpretation of Nazism. Of course, it was also applying the tenets of Marxist-Leninism in constructing a supposedly communist economy. And in addition, it consolidated a single-party system along the lines of the communist system in the Soviet Union, by forming a coalition between the Socialist Party and the Communist Party, referred to as the Socialist Unity Party, which would monopolize power in East Germany from that point on. Economically, we've talked about how the Soviet Union drew from the German territory as much as it could in the form of, quote, reparations, unquote, in return for the brutal German occupation of the Soviet Union during the war. And to do so, they dismantled almost every aspect of the East German economy. Factories, livestock, trees, completely taking over that economy. Now, this particular aspect of their policy didn't differ that much with what the Western forces were undertaking in their zones. Remember, the initial policy of the Western authorities was to transform Germany into a rural agricultural state according to the Morgenthau Plan, which would make sure that Germany would never rise up to trouble the international world again. Now, as we've seen, as a result of the Cold War conflict between the Soviet Union and Western nations, especially the United States, the Western policy shifted with the development of the Marshall Plan, infusing investment into Western Europe in general in order to establish an economic bulwark against the threat of communist communism spreading into an ineffective economy in Western territories. The establishment of a new currency in the West, which really isolated the German East German system. And triggered a drastic measure on the part of the Soviet policymakers, which was to blockade Berlin from the West altogether, starting in June of 1948 and lasting until May of 1949. Of course, this was the period of the Berlin airlift, where American pilots, for the most part, provided supplies to a city that was cut off from Western economies at the rate of, I have here, 8,000 tons a day, and earned the appreciation of many Berliners, especially young Berliners, from that point on. Now, after that comes the formal constitution of West Germany in May of 1949. And we've talked about that, headed by Adenauer of the conservative CDU. And after that, in October of 1949, the German Democratic Republic, GDR in English, and DDR in German, Deutsche Demokratische Republik, was established. Now, this competition went on either side, pressing to impose its system on the German population and earn the loyalty of each side. And in the long run, we can see that the East German system was not able to convince its citizens that it was superior. And although I'm a cultural historian and tried to emphasize the spiritual aspects of these things, there's really no doubt that it was the economic contrast that had the greatest impact on East Germany and ultimately led to its greatest difficulties and ultimate end. And this was clear really from the start, because as the economic miracle unfolded in the West, East Germans voted mainly with their feet. They simply started to get up and leave and migrate to the West. This was referred to during the period as the brain drain, because young people would obtain their education in a very fair and open system, at least as far as the opportunities for lower class people to get education, get their medical degrees, get their engineering degrees, get their technical degrees, and then move their families to the West. And so East Germany was suffering from this loss of the best and the brightest. That's what ultimately brought about the construction of the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall was not erected in order to keep the West out, in other words, to block Western forces from invading, although there certainly were Russian soldiers there ready to do that. The Berlin Wall was constructed to keep East Germans in, to keep them from fleeing to the West and pursuing their piece of the economic miracle. That's what was taking place on August 13, 1961, when, starting very early in the morning, East German border patrols and troops started literally building a wall that cut through the tripartite, now bi-zones of Berlin, and ultimately surrounded the whole of the West German territories, and then extended across the East German border to the south and west of Berlin. So the Berlin Wall was more than just a wall around Berlin, but a wall across the border, the zones, east and west, establishing real isolation for the inhabitants of the eastern territories. Now, I tell you this because I have encountered people who have either forgotten or simply aren't aware that when we talk about the Berlin Wall, we are talking about a physical wall. This was a wall of about 13 feet high, on average, I believe, about a foot and a half thick of concrete, poured concrete and rebar, with what's that stuff called at the top? Barbed wire is draped across the top, depending on where you were. Death strips, referred to as death strips, usually on the East German side of minefields, electronic surveillance, machine gun setup, guard towers, lights, dogs, a truly dangerous set of weaponry in order to keep East Germans from fleeing the Eastern Territory. By the way, the wall was constructed about 10 or 15 feet inside East German territory. They wanted to make sure that they didn't cross the border, thus triggering Western response. So if you were walking along the wall on the western side, you were actually walking in East German territory, and East German guards would yell down to you or point to you that you should get back away from the wall. And in strict international legal terms, they were correct. You were walking on East German territory, but most people didn't pay too much attention to that on the west side. Now, within the East German world, as I've said, the political system was dominated by a single party whose leadership answered primarily to Moscow. It worked hard to legitimate itself through intense Marxist-Leninist rhetoric. And I can confirm that because I did work on Beethoven interpretation in East Germany, and every concert review, every concert brochure, every analysis published about Beethoven's person or Beethoven's music was just littered with this Marxist interpretation of his music, of his biography, of the social circumstances behind his life and his work. It's not that all of this was inaccurate. Much of it was based on certain aspects of Beethoven's experience, drawing conclusions from very selective aspects of that, which is true of just about any politicized interpretation of the music. But it was universal. There were no contrary views, and it was just constantly crammed down their throats, this Marxist-Leninist perspective on, in this case, music, but just about every aspect of social existence. Now, whether or not this ideology, which is fascinating from a cultural historical point of view, it's interesting to try to draw connections between Nazi ideology and propaganda methods and East German ideology and propaganda methods, even though they came from the opposite ends of the spectrum. In the end, I have to admit that the real issues were economic. And in this, there's no doubt that life was much grayer, much more dreary, much less satisfying in the East than it was in the West. Here are just a few elements of that. Following the economic model of the Soviet Union, the East German economy was centrally planned. All properties and business were sort of placed under state control. And in the long run, this system did not function as effectively as the West German competitive market did. Every object was created by design from some sort of central planner. I can tell you some other memories, but for instance, the production of shoes. Every shoe had, for the most part, the same sole. All that they would change would be, according to fashion, would be the top that was attached to that sole. So you can see how they tried to keep up with the West with certain kinds of tennis shoes, certain kinds of track shoes, and so on and so forth. But you looked at it, and the sole was exactly the same. There wasn't any competition to create a better sole. They had those. They formatted them. They pumped them out. And then they would just simply put a different canvas or leather top on it. It looked kind of funny from Western perspective, but it was certainly indicative of this sort of centralized planning and its inability to be flexible. Here are some statistics from The Economist regarding household equipment in 1988, comparing Eastern with Western German statistics. In 1988, 90% of Western German households had a car, 97%. In the East, 52%. In the West, 94% had color TVs. In the East, again, 52%. In the West, 98% had a telephone. And in the East, I'm reading here, only 7% had a telephone. Thinking back, of course, my experience, everyone's experience trying to call and contact someone over in the East was indicative of this statistical reality. It was very hard to reach through. Only certain number of calls were allowed through at any particular time or maybe per day. And if you were in the West and had an appointment, you would have to try numerous times to get through and make to confirm that, maybe over a week. Before you could actually connect with someone. So that was a hard reality. Now, looking at these statistics, 52% had cars, 52% had color TVs. That also should take into account the fact that the quality of these objects that they did have was certainly inferior to that which the Western households enjoyed. And the most obvious example of that are the cars. The most famous symbol of East German economy was the Trabi, or Trabant, which was this little three-stroke automobile that they produced out of pressed cardboard, essentially, with a shellac over the top of it. And people would wait for years and years to obtain one of those cars. They were very, you know, glad to get them, and that amounted to the 50% of families that owned them. But they were certainly nothing compared to the automobiles being produced by Mercedes-Benz, Audi, BMW in the West, and so forth. Just a few recollections of the major differences between East and West German economies and environments. One thing that I noticed right away was that when you went over to the East, and if you were able to obtain a seat in a bar or a nightclub, by the way, they only had limited supplies for any night, so they could only accept a certain number of clients, and once that number had been reached, they wouldn't let anybody else in the door. So I remember a number of occasions where East German friends were trying to show me a good time, and we just went from place to place and weren't able to even get a beer. But when we were, the beer didn't even taste good. And to me, that was a sure sign that something was wrong, because if Germans weren't producing good beer, there was certainly something completely demoralized about the culture. Along with drinking, one of the things that every Westerner noticed was that at any social function, whether it be at a reception for some sort of university or government occasion, I was invited to a number of those, or let's say a reception at a concert event, a music event, or if you just went into one of the better cafes along Unter den Linden, the main street in what was then East Berlin. They always served the same refreshment, and that was an artificial orange drink. It was not citrus based, because they did not have access to tropical fruit of any kind. It was an artificial kind of orange drink, and you would drink this with little toasts with a kind of cream cheese and an olive on the top. And no matter what kind of function you went to, this is what was served. Seemed to be ubiquitous. And, the punchline to this story is that after the wall did open, one of the companies that went in and made a quick profit before things changed too much was Tang. Because in comparison to the artificial orange drink that was being produced in East Germany, Tang was absolutely delicious. So they went in there very quickly before Eastern Europeans had an opportunity to taste fresh squeezed orange juice or juice from concentrate. And Tang was very popular for a short period there. Now, the ultimate slap in the face in East Germany, as well as other Eastern European countries, was the fact that they knew the difference for the most part. Part of that was through access to Western television, so that they could see there the advertising and the Western world that was depicted in even American shows that were broadcast in the West. And, of course, this was something that the East tried to control, but perhaps didn't control enough in the long part. One of the funny phenomena of Eastern towns was that they would build these antennae in order to obtain Western broadcasts, and in low-lying towns and valleys further to the east, they would erect these really tall antennae to try to get those signals. So you could see the effort that they made in order to get information about the West. But they didn't even have to look that far, because in every city there were intershops where you could buy Western goods if you had Western currency. And in there they had the best watches and the best cigarettes and the best pens and the technology and most of the luxury goods that Westerners enjoyed. And this drove Easterners crazy. It was a way for the Soviet nations to obtain some hard currency from Western visitors, and but it was basically a black market run by the government, and there they could see the things that they were looking for, or things that they were missing, I should say. As you walked around East Germany, you could see the disrepair, dead construction sites at which it seemed no one had been working for years, unfinished apartment buildings, not painted since the war. Of course, it was fascinating historically to walk around in areas and see shrapnel holes in the walls, or even machine gun holes in the walls that hadn't been repaired since 1945. Bartering was really the only way to get things done. You had to trade with tradesmen and carpenters and so on, and that was a long process often. Really scary was the extent of pollution in the East, and this was a major issue when the East and West were unified. Western environmentalists were really concerned about what had taken place in eastern rivers, and immediately worked to try to reverse those things. Western German environmental policy, brought about by the Greens over the last 20 years or so, were quickly imposed on the East, and I can tell you, it looked to me like they really needed it. First of all, they burned brown coal, in order to, which is a cheap kind of coal, in order to heat their apartment. So as soon as you went over to the East, you could smell the difference. It smells much, very stringent, and kind of burns your nose. So this brown coal was being burned, and if you went into the smaller towns out in the outskirts of that, you'd see factories with open cans of chemical waste just sitting in what looked like dump sites, and it looked like the stuff was pouring out into the streets. And you know, you really, even if you're not even that concerned with the environment, were struck by what appeared to be a potential for an environmental catastrophe over there. When you crossed over, you were given, required to change a certain amount of money for your day's stay, and as I recall, it was 40 marks, which was then was something like $25 or something like that. Well, that might not seem so bad, but you weren't able to bring any of that out, so you had to figure out a way to spend it in the East, and the problem was that there really wasn't much to spend it on. So everybody usually ended up at the Karl Marx bookstore, which is actually featured in the film. That was down at the other end of Unter den Linden, and you would rummage around there looking for some books to buy. Well, this was another indication of how little there was in terms of a consumer society, because there were, you know, very few contemporary books. What there were classics, and then Marxist-Leninist treatises on just about anything you can imagine, as well as calendars that featured East German construction accomplishments, tractors, production, agricultural production. In other words, not exactly the kind of calendar that you want to hang up in your dorm room. Now, this wasn't just a result of the economic policies, but this was an indication of the cultural control that was imposed on the East German side. Crossing over, you were checked very carefully to make sure that you weren't bringing over any West German materials or Western materials or American books, magazines of any kind. This also manifested itself at the state library. That's where I would go and do work. And I was looking actually for the most part for East German materials. But in the Staatsbibliothek, the main library, state library, on Unter den Linden as well, I also had a reason to search through some other things that were only in the East. The German libraries, the Berlin libraries, had been split at the end of the war, one in the East and the one in the West. They had the card catalog in the West, but they had most of the materials in the East. So you would search for your reference numbers in the West, and then you had to go over to the East in order to see if they could find them. Anyway, so I was looking for some materials that weren't readily available to East German citizens, and these were made were accessible only in what was known as the poison room, the Giftkammer. And there they did have Western materials in this single room of the library. They had the Der Spiegel, West German magazine, West German newspapers, and they also that's where they had materials from the Nazi period and other historical resources. But this was a room where only people like myself, Westerners or East Germans with very specific clearance, were able to work. And I don't know if what it was used for, but I do remember that was it was a very small room. Maybe 25 people could sit in there at most at tables, and the door had a window on it. I don't know if they were actually peering in or it was just symbolic of the possibility that they were peering in. But, you know, it's very likely that they were monitoring, especially what East Germans were looking at in there. This, for me, was probably the clearest manifestation of the kind of monitoring that was going on in the East. I'm sure that my friends were much more concerned about it than I was, since they were hosting me. I do remember speaking a little bit too loudly in a cafe with one of my friends, and he sort of indicated to me that he wasn't comfortable with that. And I realized how unconscious I was of that sort of thing. I don't even know if I was talking about East German politics, but maybe used some names of West German politicians. And he simply indicated that I should keep my voice down when I speak about those kinds of things. Other than that, I do remember seeing cameras on the streets in East Germany. Of course, now we have cameras all over the street in Chicago, so things have progressed one way or the other, I guess. But that was in a particular area right off of Unter den Linden near the wall, and it was the area in which the Stasi building and other intelligence agencies were operating. So, you know, of course you have security cameras on the outside of American government buildings at all. Perhaps we're projecting our own, some sort of fear on the East German citizen when we look at East German security cameras. But obviously, as the film indicated, the use of surveillance in order to acquire information that could be used in order to control the citizenry of East Germany was a constant in this world. I'll leave it to our resources to tell you a little bit more about this, but I think it's important to point out that after the first decade, we'll say, the mode of terror applied to East German citizens was not as physical as had been the case under Nazi Nazi system, but rather psychological and economic. Now, to be sure, hundreds, if not thousands, of those deemed political opponents to the Soviet occupation were physically arrested and eliminated in the first years of the occupation, and an individual could certainly lived in constant fear of losing one's freedom as well as one's life. And obviously extreme cases, East German citizens could be arrested and spend extended periods of time in jail. But for the most part, the threat was one of occupational terror. If one stepped out of line, if one was heard stating anti-Soviet positions, if one made jokes about the regime, or if one was seen to speak too highly of the West or make indications that one might be interested in fleeing to the West or helping others to flee the West, so on and so forth. What was jeopardized was the possibility for any advance in one's career, or perhaps losing any position that one had in that career and being set back. One manifestation of this was the fact that a number of, let's say, more active, critical students at universities, if you were outspoken in any way at the university, you wouldn't be accepted into any of the programs that might lead to some sort of financial security or success or status positions within the state. But one could only take theology. And as a result, you have this influx of a lot of radical thinking, sort of outgoing personalities in theology, which in the long run explains why a lot of the critical voices and critical activities came out of the evangelical church, out of the Protestant church. It wasn't just because of the principles of the church, but it was because they had sort of created a community of critical thinking ministers through this policy. That's one theory that I've read. But it's just an indication of the sort of occupational or an economic pressure that was put on people to conform, in addition to the more extreme. But this would have been more common within the East German system for your average citizen than perhaps you might imagine. So that's a sketch with some personal reflections on conditions in East Germany as a result of leadership of the SED backed by the Soviet hierarchy. Now, the movie we're going to see largely speaks for itself. And I don't think it'll take that much interpretation, at least it's not as much as the symbolism of Maria Braun. It's not an art movie. It's a narrative story done in, quote, Hollywood style, unquote, which accounted for its popularity and doesn't involve as much or doesn't require as much interpretation as Fassbinder's more complex cinema did. So it doesn't. I don't think I'll have to say as much about what each of these scenes means. But the background reading that I've provided to you, the article by Timothy Garton Ash, the article by Anthony Lane, even the article by William Buckley, provides some context for this. And I think the most important point to be drawn from it is, first of all, that the filmmaker himself was only 16 years old in 1989, and he's a Westerner, did not actually directly experience the East German regime. The actor who plays the Stasi agent was a a citizen of the of East German Republic, and the German Democratic Republic, and was actually engaged with the reform efforts in 1989. So he knew this world very well, and certainly brings a good sense of its atmosphere in his performance. The general environment that the film depicts is held to be quite accurate. The kind of physical existence that East German lived under. But of course, most important here is the issue of the Stasi surveillance of East German citizens and the policies by which it imposed this economic, if we will, professional, occupational terror on dissidents and those that deemed threats either to flee or to act for reform. As Timothy Garton Ash writes most effectively, being one of the most important scholars of the period, having written specifically about East German surveillance policy, specifically about his own file and the involvement of people he knew when he was visiting there in the 70s. So someone who really knows this material well. As he indicates, the Stasi has come to be a real symbol for the extremes to which German ingenuity can be applied in order to gather information about political opponents. And, of course, the extent to which the Stasi worked to gather this information and the amount of information that it did gather is legendary. I recently visited, or when I went to Washington and Baltimore, I went to the Spy Museum there, and a great amount of the information that they have there is about the East German system. Partly because it was so extreme, partly because it was so well documented, as Ash indicates. The mountains of information that they had on everybody, the extent to which they used friends, family, divided them among themselves in order to gather information, usually using this kind of economic and professional pressure on people. The use of extreme techniques such as the surveillance that's depicted here in the film, but also, you know, absurd things like gathering smells of individuals so that they could be searched for using guard dogs, and that anybody, thousands if not hundreds of thousands of vials with swabs of a human smell were maintained and meticulously recorded. As Timothy Garton Ash indicates, he had a file of over 350 pages. A single, at that time, college-age scholar living there generated that much attention from the Stasi. You can imagine what someone from East Germany with a, you know, more high-profile dissident status might have generated literally thousands of pages on particular individuals with friends, lovers, family members reporting on them. So, as a case study in government surveillance of individuals, of course, the Stasi system in East Germany is highly symbolic. The interpreters of the film in these background readings indicate there are some exaggerations, some misrepresentations of some of the details here. But in the long run, they feel it stands up as an indication of the extremes to which the East German government went in order, remember, simply to maintain itself, for the most part, to keep people from fleeing to the West. That's really the fundamental issue. And, of course, to protect its reputation vis-a-vis the West. The pivotal issue that the director has used here is that of suicides in the East. And I guess that stands for every aspect of the East that might have trigger those kind of statistics that he uses as the basis for the article that the author is producing. But the particular case that triggers that act on the part of the author in the film is the suicide of his friend, who kills himself because of his inability to progress as an artist, to have his works produced. So he's under this occupational pressure, this occupational terror, and that triggers his self-destruction. So it's symbolic of that particular theme in most intensively. So anyway, those are some of the things that we can look for in the film that I think the film draws out pretty directly, and that you could certainly construct an essay or interpretation around.